43-year-old Lakewood police officer Richard Swanson called the police dispatcher this past Thursday and announced that he was going to take his own life. A number of his police friends rushed to Clement Park, and there they watched helplessly as this 1990 Officer of the Year and much decorated cop proceeded to shoot himself. I only know what I have read in the Rocky Mountain News about this situation, and yet as I read it, I had to ask myself the question, what would drive a man to such action? Who would have guessed at age 25 that his life would come to this? Is it possible that Richard Swanson had built his life around something that was insufficient? Is it possible that his reasons for living were no longer powerful enough to sustain him in a crisis or crises? Well, I don't know the answers to those questions, but it seems to me that it is possible that here is a man who illustrates what happens to so many people, and that is that they finally realize that what they have built their life around is not sufficient. James Fowler wrote these words, "I am 33 years of age and in perfect health. It is 4 a.m., and the darkness of a cold, wintry morning. Suddenly, I am fully and frighteningly awake. I see it clearly. I'm going to die. I am going to die. This body, this mind, this husband, father, teacher, son, and friend will cease to be. The tide of life that propels me with such force will cease, and I, this I taken so much for granted by me, will no longer walk this earth." He said a strange feeling of remoteness came over him. He said, "My wife beside me in bed seems completely out of reach. My daughters asleep in the other parts of the house seemed this moment like vague memories of people I had once known. My work, my professional associates, my ambitions, my dreams, my absorbing projects, they suddenly feel like fiction. What most people would call real life suddenly to me in this darkness feels like a transient dream. As never before, I found myself asking, when all these persons and relations and projects that shape and fill my life, when they are removed, who or what is left? When the I that is me steps into the velvet darkness, will there be this same center of consciousness, this I am, or not? And if so, by whom will I be met? What continuities will there be between these full, fleeting days and years that I now taste and savor, and any enlargement of time that I may yet experience?" James Fowler felt more alone than he had ever felt before in his life, but it helped him focus as never before. Was he truly alone in this universe? Or was there something or someone that gave his life a context, a place to belong, a reason to live? Was there anything out there that is truly big enough to provide his life with meaning and security? Anything large enough that can become the center of his life, around which he can build his life with certainty? Most men and women reach a place in their life where they ask these kinds of questions. What am I doing all this for? I beat myself to get a job and to keep the job, but for what? I'm in the fast lane, but where's the lane going? Is there a larger context in which my life makes sense? Paul Tillich, not a theologian that I would recommend for his theology, nevertheless has written a very good question in his book, The Dynamics of Faith, when he asks, what values have centering power in your life? I repeat it. What values have centering power in your life? Or in other words, what do you center your life around? Whether people can articulate it or not, they have a philosophy of life. There is something that they have grown up with or that they have adopted, that they have placed in the center of life, and they have begun to order their life around that something. They hold these things to be true. And they believe that those things or that ideal or that cause is somehow going to give meaning and security to their life. Every human being needs meaning and security. As to meaning, it's interesting that as far as we know, only human beings ask why. Only human beings are the ones who want to know reasons and priorities. As to security, we learn very early in life that we are dependent creatures, dependent on others for our very survival. We're not very old when we begin to understand that life is a very dangerous experience and we need help. And then when we learn of death early in life, it is frightening beyond words. And that fear stays with most people. And so early in life, we begin to search for meaning and security. Now, I think most children rightly seek and find some measure of meaning and security in their parents. Children build their lives around their parents. But by the time they reach their teen years, they discover that their parents are just as fallible as they are, just as finite, and just as much in need of meaning and security as themselves. And so it no longer suffices. The parents no longer are the complete center and core of the child's life. Where then does a young person look for meaning and security? What center is big enough and strong enough to provide the meaning and security for a human being? Well, by the time that youngster is a teenager, they have been introduced to many gods, some religious, but most of them secular. Gods who would claim to be sufficient to be the center of that young person's life. Gods who would claim to be powerful enough to give them meaning and security. But those lesser gods, in the long run, don't cut it. For instance, a young woman may believe that she is finding the right young man and that in finding him, she is finding the very meaning and security around which she can build her life. How sad when she discovers, probably sooner rather than later, that her knight's armor is not shining but rusty. How about the young man or the young woman who believes that following the right educational and career path will provide for them that center of life around which they can order their life and build their lives? How sad when their career is interrupted, or sadder yet, when their career goes on an entire lifetime and they reach the end and are handed a gold watch. It's around that that I built my life. The central character in our text today, Acts chapter 9, was probably around 35 years of age. I would guess about 10 years out of grad school. And now picked by his bosses for the most politically advantageous task of his career. For if he could pull this off, he would have reached the place where he wanted to be. Well, you see, his bosses had been given the authority to go to the nearby country and to extradite people who were all over the news. Can you imagine what a political plum to be able to go there and bring those people back to the chief priests? To pull this thing off would make his career. Please turn in your Bibles to Acts chapter 8 and look with me at the beginning of the story. We find this young man, whose name is Saul, first recorded for us in Acts 7, about the 58th verse, and then again in Acts 8, verse 1. And it says that Saul was present and approving when Stephen was murdered. After the death of Stephen, as we have looked at in previous weeks, according to Acts 8, 1, there was unleashed on the church in Jerusalem a firestorm of persecution. Now, if you have ever read about or seen anything of what is called Kristallnacht, that pre-World War II Nazi Germany persecution of Jews, people who were driven from their homes, beaten, and in many cases killed, you would get some idea of what this persecution was like in the city of Jerusalem at this time. And according to verse 3 of Acts 8, Saul was at the very center of these raids, imprisonments, and even killings. question I have is, what's driving that young man? What is at the center of his life? What is at the core of his life around which he is ordering all of these activities? What's going on inside of that young man? What values is he centering on? And will that core of his life prove sufficient for that young man in the long run? Fortune magazine's editors sent reporters to talk to 80 of the country's most promising 25-year-old young businessmen and women to try to discover what are the values that that group holds dearest. The values that that group held most dear were the values of success. And they defined success as eventually achieving financial independence. And along the way toward achieving financial independence, they would take over and achieve the top-ranking leadership positions in corporate America. And the foundations on which they relied were their own abilities, good luck, and their capacity for hard work. And their faith was in the international corporation, believing that the international corporations were those organizations, those entities that were going to form the future of the world. What was the center of their life? What was the core? What had they centered their life on? Financial independence as achieved through rising in the corporate structure of international companies. And everything in life was ordered around that center. How did that ordering look? Well, they made it very clear in their conversations that yes, marriage is a very good thing to have, but make sure that that marriage does not get in the way of the advancement of your career. Because at the center is financial independence through career advancement. What about children? Great idea. Love to have children as long as they don't interfere with the career. What about loyalty to a company or to a community? Oh no. The fastest way to rise is to move and to move often. The center of their lives was the corporate world, and everything in life was ordered around that. How would it help them achieve that core, that center of their lives? The question you might ask is, how will that center serve them in their next 40 years? Will that center sustain them amidst the pain, amidst betrayals, amidst death, amidst aging? Will that center then prove sufficient in their life? You know, though most people would not admit it, and certainly these young men and women probably would not, they know that they are finite. And therefore, they are trying to attach themselves to something that is bigger than themselves, something that can give them meaning and security. And though they have picked something bigger than themselves, what is sad is that they have picked something else that is just as finite as themselves. They have chosen a lesser God, a God that is not sufficient. What you give your life to, what you trust will give your life meaning and security, that can honestly be called your God. That's not an inappropriate use of that word. And what those 25-year-olds don't know yet is that their God is not big enough. Their God is not strong enough. Their God is not long-lasting enough. They have chosen a lesser God, and their God will fail them. In Acts 8 and 9, we find that apparently Saul had accepted such a God, a finite little God not worthy of his life. When Saul, in Acts chapters 22 and 26, tells his own story, Luke tells it for us here in Acts 9, but Luke records Saul's personal testimony in Acts 22 and 26. When Saul tells the story himself, he talks about his obsession for destroying Christians. He tells the Galatians how zealous he is for the law. He tells them that he is a Hebrew of Hebrews and he studied at the feet of Gamaliel. He is absolutely committed to the law of the Pharisees. Just as those 25-year-olds placed at the center of their life their corporate world, so Saul has placed at the center of his life and is trusting in his relationship to the law. For he was convinced that if he would keep the law, if he would protect the law, if he would abide by the law, somehow that law would give him security and that law would give him meaning for life. He believed it to such an extent that he was willing to kill to protect it. Why such hostility toward Christians on the part of Saul? Because Saul knew that if those Christians were right about who Jesus Christ is, then that says something about his center, his lesser God. They can't both be right. Paul has chosen for the center of his life the law. And he wants nothing to disturb that because he's given himself to it. But an interesting thing happens to Saul as he's on his way to Damascus. By the time he nears that city to extradite the Christians there, I believe that there are some doubts rising in his mind. I say that based on Jesus' words to Saul in that encounter. Now, the words that I'm going to refer to are not recorded in Acts 9. They are recorded in Acts 26, and they are words that some of you who've grown up in Sunday school will remember. Jesus said to Saul, "It is hard for you to kick against the goads." You ever remember hearing those words before and wondering what they meant? Well, it was a very common rural proverb, and it simply meant this: how can you keep resisting the truth, Saul? That alone gives me some insight into what's going on in that man's mind. Evidently, Saul is not quite so sure. He's been hearing something to the contrary. That is, he was committed to the law as the center of his life, but something has been gnawing away at that. Well, you see, Saul was a contemporary of Jesus, and I think there is every reason to believe that he had seen Jesus. We know for certain from the text that he had seen Stephen, and that he had heard that powerful sermon that Stephen preached. And he saw the face of Stephen appear as an angel, as it's recorded for us in the scriptures. And then he heard that man with his own ears as Stephen asked for God's forgiveness on Saul and the others, even as they were stoning Stephen to death. You don't easily get that out of your mind. He'd heard of all the miracles of Jesus, and he saw and heard the conviction and commitment of those Christian people who would rather lose their livelihood and their homes and even their lives than go back on their commitment to Jesus. And yes, this man Saul had heard every one of them claim that Jesus is alive. So I can only imagine the struggle that is going on in his mind as he approaches that city. On the one hand, he says, no, the law. I must protect the law. I've given my life to the law. I've ordered my life around it. I've given myself to it. And yet in his mind's eye, he could see Stephen's face. And in his ears were ringing those words from that sermon. And in his own mind, he also heard again and again the conviction of those people. And he was torn. And now on the road to Damascus, even as he is nearing that city to prosecute those Christians, Jesus himself confronts Saul. And the very presence of Jesus challenges Saul's little god of religion. And just like James Fowler at 4 o'clock on that wintry morning, so Saul comes face to face with the insufficiency of his lesser god. Because Saul has met the God. And if Jesus is who he claims to be, then Saul's faith is in something that will ultimately fail him. As great a cause as it may appear to be, as well as he may be able to articulate it in God terms and religious terms, it will fail him. And that becomes abundantly clear when he stands in the presence of the God. Okay, Saul, maybe you haven't considered it before, but now's the time for you to decide. What center will you build your life around? Will you choose one of the lesser gods that you were introduced to out of childhood and adolescence and adulthood? Or will you choose the God? And by God's grace, Saul saw it clearly. And Saul was converted. Look in your Bible, please, at Acts chapter 9, verse 20. As you look at that, I want you to remember that in Acts 26, Saul said that formerly he was convinced that he must do everything he possibly could to oppose the name of Jesus of Nazareth. Now what do you find this man Saul doing in Acts 9, verse 20? He is preaching in the synagogues to the Jews that Jesus is who? The Son of God. Folks, what a transformation. What an incredible conversion. Here is a man who was moving in the direction of opposing everything that Jesus stood for reasons I suggested earlier, and now he has turned from that. He has converted from that being the center of his life, that being the core around which he ordered his life, to Jesus being the center of his life. He changed from trusting in the law to trusting in Jesus. He changed from trusting in the finite to trusting in the infinite. From trusting in his man-made God of religion to trusting in the God. And by God's grace, Saul came to realize that any other center was insufficient. And only by centering his life on Jesus could he know ultimate meaning and eternal security. And so it is in that God, Jesus Christ, that Saul now places his trust. And it is to that God, Jesus, that he now gives his total allegiance, his life, his energies, his time, his money. What about you? What are you being spent for? What are you giving your life for? What commands and receives your best time and your best energy? What causes or dreams or goals or institutions are you pouring your life out for? What stands at the center? In what do you trust to give your life meaning and purpose? An unfortunate change has taken place in recent years. It's the change in the meaning of a word. The word is believe. There was a time when the word believe meant trust, but no longer. Today, the word believe means simply to hold certain ideas to be true. Do you believe in Jesus? Yes, I believe in Jesus. I believe he existed. I believe he died for sins. I believe that he is God. You hold those theological ideas to be true. But those ideas do not hold sway in your life. Those ideas do not dictate how you live. They do not order your actions and your thoughts. They do not form the center around which your life is ordered. You simply believe them. But trust is of a different nature. That's what you set your heart on. That's what you commit yourself to. That's what you build your life on and around. People may say that they believe in many things, but you will know nothing about them until you know in what they trust. What do their actions, what do their investments, what does the use of their time tell you about what they trust in? What's at the center of their life? Saul met Jesus, and in meeting him, he met the God, the supreme center of life, the only one who could give ultimate meaning and security to life itself. There are many, many lesser gods that would claim the center of your life. But not religion, not creeds, not doctrine, only Jesus. Only a relationship to Jesus, the living God, is sufficient center for life. Have you met Jesus? Again, I'm not asking you, do you believe in him? I'm asking, in what or in whom do you trust? What's at the center of your life? Stand with me, please, in closing prayer.